This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. Iran's president says Donald Trump's political career is over today, while bipolarity of the U.S. society and Washington's isolation are what he has left behind. Security remains tight in Washington, D.C. hours before the inauguration of Joe Biden as the 46th president of the United States. Donald Trump praises his administration's efforts to combat the coronavirus pandemic, while the U.S. death toll from the disease tops 400,000 during his final hours in office. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour, the Iranian president says U.S. President Donald Trump's dark and vicious rule has come to an end, leaving behind a legacy of political isolation for Washington.
One of the results of Trump's amateurish and tyrannical actions was the bipolarity of the U.S. society. Political isolation of the United States was another legacy of Trump. The U.S. was left alone in its policies. It was left alone when acting against Palestine because the majority of world countries opposed the U.S. America was also left alone regarding the Iran nuclear deal.
Rouhani added the U.S. under Trump was isolated on other occasions as well. He said the U.S. failed to rally the U.N. Security Council support against the Iran nuclear deal and failed to reinstate an arms embargo against Tehran. President Rouhani said Trump's multiple failures at the United Nations was a disgrace for the U.S. The Iranian president says his country expects the new U.S. administration to make up for the mistakes of Trump's government.
Today, we expect those who take power at the White House to return to law. We expect them to deliver on their commitments and try, if they can, to remove all the dark stains left on the U.S. in the past 4 years, because some of those dark blots cannot be removed. The new U.S. administration will shoulder a heavy responsibility.
President Rouhani said the U.S. administration should also begin abiding by international law and resolutions. He said if they act in good faith and show their honesty not only in word but in deed, Iran will fully comply with its commitments as well. Rouhani said the whole world realized that the so-called U.S. maximum pressure campaign against Iran and its economic terrorism failed. The EU foreign policy chief has urged the U.S. to return to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and stop its policy of sanctions against Tehran.
There is a deal, and the deal had a nuclear side and an economic side. The Iranians are ready to go back to the full commitment, fulfillment of their commitments, if we, the other part of the deal, the Western world, fulfills also our commitments. And for that we need the Americans to go back to the agreement, or at least to stop threatening with sanctions to everybody who participates in the economic relationship with Iran.
Borrell, in his letter to EU foreign ministers, said the Iran nuclear deal is at a critical juncture. The United States withdrew from the accord in 2018 and reimposed sanctions against Iran. A year later, Tehran began reducing its commitments. It said the measure was in response to the failure of the remaining signatories to make up for Washington's pullout. Iran says the measures are reversible if its economic interests are safeguarded and as enshrined in the nuclear deal. Security remains high in the U.S. Capitol hours before the inauguration ceremony of President-elect Joe Biden. Thousands of National Guard troops and Secret Service officers are now on duty in Washington, D.C. Most public areas have been shut down. Security checkpoints have been set up across the city. The mayor of D.C. earlier called on residents to stay out of the city during the inauguration. Other state capitals are also on high alert. Much of Biden's swearing-in ceremony is scheduled to be held virtually due to the pandemic, but security was tightened in the wake of the January 6th storming of Congress by supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump. The FBI has warned of possible armed demonstrations during Biden's inauguration. U.S. President Donald Trump has granted clemency to his former senior advisor, Steve Bannon, just hours before his term ends. Bannon had faced charges of defrauding donors to raise funds for a wall built at the Mexico border to stop migrants from coming to the U.S. He's among 142 people the outgoing U.S. president pardoned during his final hours in office. They range from rappers to lobbyists. Trump has been advised not to pardon himself, his family members, and his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. A few weeks ago, Trump pardoned dozens of other people, including his first national security advisor, Michael Flynn. Those people also included four guards jailed for killing Iraqi civilians in 2007. The pardoning of them has caused controversy. While outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump has defended his administration's handling of the coronavirus in the country, that's the world's hardest hit nation by the pandemic.
When our nation was hit with the terrible pandemic, we produced not one, but two vaccines with record-breaking speed, and more will quickly follow. They said it couldn't be done, but we did it. They called it a medical miracle, and that's what they're calling it right now, a medical miracle. Another administration would have taken 3, 4, 5, maybe even up to 10 years to develop a vaccine. We did it in 9 months. No nation can long
thrive. In his farewell speech, Trump did not refer to the death toll of more than 400,000 from the pandemic, but said he grieves for every life lost. Without mentioning incoming President Joe Biden, Trump said he wants luck for the next administration. The outgoing leader condemned the storming of the U.S. Capitol by his supporters earlier this month when lawmakers were certifying Biden's win. Trump called for unity around shared values. He also boasted about his performance regarding the most controversial issues, including immigration. Political expert Gloria LaRiva says there is enormous relief that Trump's term has come to an end.
There is so much to say. It would take a whole program to talk about the crimes of Donald Trump. And that's why there's enormous relief right now. The problem still exists. As you said, 400,000 people have died. The vaccines are being held up. Not enough were produced, largely because of Trump's failure, his criminal neglect, really, on the COVID crisis. And yet, despite all these problems, there is an administration. We have our own view about Joe Biden and the new incoming administration. It still heads up the most powerful imperialist system in the world. However, the message of unity and respecting diversity among the population, of denouncing the white supremacists and the neo-Nazis, is a very important thing to do. And there is a lot of fall away from those who were supporting Trump all these years. It was, for many of them, intolerable, as one called it, the red line, when he called on the fascists on January 6th to storm the Capitol. So there's much, much to be seen what happens tomorrow.
On the very last day of President Donald Trump's administration, a polarized United States remains on edge over the prospect of election-related violence. But while a significant minority is sad to see Trump leave, a majority in the U.S. and seemingly across the world appear to be quite happy that the Trump era has come to an end. Nami Mazzotti has more from Chicago.
The final sun is setting on the presidency of Donald J. Trump. Domestically, many are not just breathing a sigh of relief, but screaming with happiness. And yet polls say 35% of the country believes he is being ousted illegitimately. That illustrates just how polarizing Trump has been here. And while many wonder if he'll run for president in 2024, many others hope he is leaving public office permanently.
Alhamdulillah, that tomorrow is Trump's last day in the White House as the president of the United States. I don't feel that it is Trump's last day as being a tyrant, being a terrorist, being a thief. But I feel that I'm very happy that that we can get back to moving forward here in the United States.
Trump seemed to combine Barack Obama's skill in manipulating the media, George W. Bush's readiness to provoke international hatred, Bill Clinton's ability to disregard the truth, and Ronald Reagan's jingoism. He was routinely and credibly accused of conduct which degraded public service, of re-legitimizing American white supremacy, of intentionally provoking societal rifts, and much, much more. Trump's ascension provoked the greatest burst of political activity and independent journalism in the U.S. in 50 years. Black Lives Matter, Me Too, the importance of voting, and other progressive movements seemed to be in direct response to his regular use of sexism, racism, jingoism, and elitism. Internationally, Trump took America's post-9/11, you're either with us or against us worldview to a new extreme. He illegally tore up international agreements, banned travel from 7 mostly Muslim countries, and antagonized longtime U.S. allies. Trump, who switched his party affiliation 5 times, has successfully reshaped the Republican Party. He was the first 21st century mainstream politician to be openly anti-free trade, to voice opposition to America's endless wars, to admit the national decline of the U.S. since the Great Recession, to bring attention to the role of a deep state in the U.S., and to openly question the integrity of the nation's corporate-dominated media. The Trump era was truly unlike any other. His legacy will be debated, but his detractors are innumerable, intense, and international. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Elsewhere, the Iranian army's ground force has launched the second and final day of large-scale maneuvers in the south of the country. Special forces backed by helicopters carried out air mobile and offensive operations. They successfully demolished designated targets and returned to their first positions in the shortest period of time. Mobile electro-optical screening systems and geographic information systems were used for the first time during the exercises. The Iranian army has held its drills along the Makran coast of the Sea of Oman. The first day of the exercises, say special forces successfully carried out joint airborne and combat operations. The drills aimed to assess the combat readiness of the country's military units. Our correspondent Humane Abadi is joining us now from JUST with more on the military exercises for today. Humane, what do you have to share with us?
Adia, right now I'm talking to you from the site of the maneuvers in JUST port. Last hour, I gave the audience some information about the exercises last night and today. But right now, I have a guest. He's Brigadier General Amir Ghulam Alian, who is one of the commanders, Army Forces commanders, present in the drills. And he's going to share with us his thoughts. Amir, خیلی ممنون از وقتی که در اختیار ما قرار دادید.
Thank you very much for joining us. Please tell us about the operations conducted last night during nighttime and also your operation in early this morning. Please provide us with further details. In the name of God, the merciful, the compassionate, in line with Iqtidar 99 drills by the ground force, in JUST zone, for the first time in the history of the ground force, there has been 214 version choppers conducting nighttime operations, navigational operations. 4 such choppers conducted nighttime navigational operation. The landing and takeoff operations were successfully conducted in JUST. We also had nighttime firing by the choppers at nighttime. One of the points of weakness that we had with respect to these choppers was that the choppers were not able to fire bullets at nighttime, but due to, despite the sanctions and due to our innovative actions, we managed to equip the choppers and helicopters with the firing machines used for nighttime, and the 4 choppers last night managed to hit their targets at nighttime. and that's been one of the, and this is one of the outstanding points of the drills. This morning, on the second day of the drills, we conducted an offensive operation by the Rapid Reaction Force of the Army of the Islamic Republic of Iran. 12 copters, 214 version copters, transferred this to the army personnel, and they fired at the set targets, and also the hypothetical targets were occupied. And there was also a combination of operation with aerial support that was successfully conducted. What is the message of the drills? Speaking of the message of the drills, I can tell you that the message is peace and security for the region. We have on several occasions told our neighbors that regional capacities must be applied for maintaining security and tranquility in the region. Fortunately, the Islamic Republic of Iran, despite all the Iranophobic measures by the hegemonic powers, we have always conveyed this message to our neighbors that we should establish security. Trans-regional states are not able to maintain security, and those countries that depend on transregional states, they should know that without the effective presence of the Islamic Republic of Iran, without the effective presence of the Islamic Republic of Iran, there's not going to be security, and there is no need for presence of foreign forces, because the presence of foreign forces will just bring about insecurity. The Islamic Republic of Iran is capable to maintain security through interaction with neighbors, and this is a message of peace, security, and tranquility for neighboring states. Thank you very much.
Bardia, that was Brigadier General Amir Ghulam Aliyan, our guest. Over to you.
All right, thanks a lot, Human Abedi, joining us from JOSC. Also, a special thanks to your guest as well. Moving on, Iran's foreign minister has emphasized regional cooperation to tackle challenges facing countries there. In a tweet, Mohammad Javad Zarif said such collaboration will help form a strong region. He also welcomed Qatar's offer of negotiations with Iran. On Tuesday, Doha urged Persian Gulf Arab countries to hold talks with Tehran to resolve disputes. Qatar said other members of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council also share the same desire. Last month, GCC members Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and the UAE reestablished diplomatic ties with Qatar after severing them back in June 2017. The trio broke the ties at the time, partly because of Qatar's relations with Iran. Israel has carried out fresh attacks on the Gaza Strip as tensions continue to simmer in the region. Israeli artillery shelled targets in the north and center of the besieged enclave. No casualties have been reported, but material damage has occurred. Israel has confirmed the attacks, claiming they came in response to a rocket launched from northern Gaza on Tuesday evening. Israeli warplanes also launched an attack on southern Gaza on Monday, causing material damage. The surge in attacks comes as Palestinian territories prepare to hold their first parliamentary and presidential votes in 15 years. China has imposed a partial lockdown in Beijing following reports of several coronavirus cases in the capital. The restrictive measure affects 1.6 million people in a district where six people have been diagnosed with COVID-19. Residents of the area have been told to stay home. They cannot leave Beijing unless they have special permission and are tested negative for the disease. Gatherings of 50 or more people in the district have been banned, and schools have been shut in the district. China has largely brought the coronavirus under control. The country has launched mass testing for a spate of localized outbreaks. Well, that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
The specter of hunger is sensitive in Ethiopia, which transformed into one of the world's fastest growing economies in the decades since images of starvation there in the 1980s led to a global outcry. Drought and conflict contributed to the famine, which swept through Tigray region and killed an estimated 1 million people. The largely agricultural Tigray region of about 5 million people already had a food security problem amid a locust outbreak when Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed on 4th of November announced fighting between his forces and those of the defiant regional government. Leaders of Tigray region dominated Ethiopia for almost 3 decades but were sidelined after Abiy Ahmed introduced reforms that won him the Nobel Peace Prize in 2019. The article you're about to hear has been written by Kara Anna. The piece is titled Extreme Urgent Need, Starvation Haunts Ethiopia's Tigray. The article has been taken from the Chronicle.com website. Please stay with us for more of Kara Anna's article. From emaciated refugees to crops burned on the brink of harvest, starvation threatens the survivors of more than 2 months of fighting in Ethiopia's Tigray region. The first humanitarian workers to arrive after pleading with the Ethiopian government for access describe weakened children dying from diarrhea after drinking from rivers. Shops were looted or depleted weeks ago. A local official told a 1st of January crisis meeting of government and aid workers that hungry people had asked for a single biscuit. Participants say more than 4.5 million people, nearly the region's entire population, need emergency food. According to minutes obtained by the Associated Press, at their next meeting on 8th of January, a Tigray administrator warned that without aid and food, hundreds of thousands might starve to death. And some had already starved. Marie Carmen Vinoles, head of the emergency unit for Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, told the Associated Press, "There is an extreme urgent need. I don't know what more words in English to use to rapidly scale up the humanitarian response because the population is literally dying every day. They are dying as we speak." But pockets of fighting, resistance from some officials, and sheer destruction stand in the way of a massive food delivery effort. The meeting's minutes said to send 15 kilograms of rations to 4.5 million people would require more than 2,000 trucks, while some local responders are reduced to getting around on foot. The specter of hunger is sensitive in Ethiopia, which transformed into one of the world's fastest-growing economies in the decades since images of starvation there in the 1980s led to a global outcry. Drought, conflict, and government denial contributed to the famine, which swept through the Tigray region and killed an estimated 1 million people. The largely agricultural Tigray region of about 5 million people already had a food security problem amid a locust outbreak when Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed on 4th of November announced fighting between his forces and those of defiant regional government. Leaders of the Tigray region dominated Ethiopia for almost 3 decades, but were sidelined largely after Abiy Ahmed introduced reforms that won him the Nobel Peace Prize in 2019. Thousands of people have been killed in the conflict. More than 50,000 have fled into neighboring Sudan, where one doctor has said new arrivals show signs of starvation. Others shelter in rugged terrain. A woman who recently left Tigray region described sleeping in caves with people who brought cattle, goats, and the grain they had managed to harvest. A letter by the Catholic Bishop of Adigrat said recently, "It is a daily reality to hear people dying with the fighting consequences and because of lack of food." Hospitals and other health centers crucial in treating malnutrition have been destroyed. The United Nations says in markets, food is not available or extremely scarce and limited. Though Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed declared victory in late November, its military and allied fighters remain active amid the presence of troops from neighboring Eritrea, a bitter enemy of the now fugitive officials who once led the Tigray region. Fear keeps many people from venturing out. Others have fled. Tigray's new officials say more than 2 million people have been displaced. The United Nations says the number of people reached with aid is extremely low. A senior Ethiopian government official, Radwan Hussein, did not respond to a request for comment on Tigray colleagues' warning of starvation. A United Nations source said in the northern Shire area near Eritrea, which has seen some of the worst fighting, up to 10% of the children whose arms were measured met the diagnostic criteria for severe acute malnutrition, with scores of children affected. The source, speaking on condition of anonymity, sharing the concern of many humanitarian workers and aid workers about jeopardizing access to Ethiopia. Near Shire town are camps housing nearly 100,000 refugees who have fled over the years from Eritrea. United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, said recently, "Some who have walked into town are emaciated, begging for aid and begging for food that is not available." Food has been a target. Analyzing satellite imagery of the Shire area, a United Kingdom-based research group found two warehouse-style structures in the United Nations World Food Programme, WFP, compound at one refugee camp had been very specifically destroyed. The DX Open Network could not tell by whom or who has done the destruction. It reported a new attack recently. It's challenging to verify events in Tigray region as communication links remain poor and almost no journalists are allowed to visit the region. Meanwhile, an official with Doctors Without Borders, Médecins Sans Frontières, Renoles, has said that in the towns of Adigrat, Adwa, and Aksum, the level of civilian casualties is extremely high in the places we have been able to access. She cited the fighting and lack of health care in the towns of Adigrat, Adwa, and Aksum. She said hunger is very concerning and water is scarce in the region. Just 2 of 21 wells still work in Adigrat, a city of more than 140,000, forcing many people to drink from the local river. With sanitation suffering, disease is spreading fast in the region. Benola said, "You go 10 kilometers from the city and it's a complete disaster with no food." Humanitarian workers struggle to gauge the extent of the need of the peoples of the region. Panos Navrozidis, Action Against Hunger's director in Ethiopia, said, "Not being able to travel off main highways, it always poses the question of what's happening with people still off limits." Before the conflict, Ethiopia's National Disaster Management Body classified some Tigray wardas, or administrative areas, as priority regions or priority one hotspots for food insecurity. Panos Navrozidis, Action Against Hunger's director, said, "If some already had high malnutrition numbers 2.5 months into the crisis, it's a safe assumption that thousands of children and mothers are in immediate need of food and aid." The Famine Early Warning System Network says parts of central and eastern Tigray region are likely in emergency phase 4, just a step below famine. John Shumlansky, the Catholic Relief Services representative in Ethiopia, said the next few months are critical. Shumlansky said his group so far has given up to 70,000 people in Tigray region a 3-month food supply. Asked whether combatants use hunger as a weapon in Ethiopia, one concern among aid workers, John Shumlansky dismissed it by Ethiopian Defense Forces and police. With others, he didn't know. He said, "I don't think they have food either, though."
The debate.
Hello, and a warm welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm Behrouz Najafi. January 20th is expected to usher a new era in U.S. politics. This, of course, following 4 years of jingoism, blame games, and divisive policies practiced by the Trump administration. The Pentagon is so worried about insider attacks by service members that it had the guards tasked with securing the ceremony vetted. Now, what's made Washington, D.C. resemble a garrison? Is a large National Guard deployment supposed to protect Americans against their fellow countrymen? What's going on in the United States? Does the inauguration mark the end of Trumpism, or is the ideology there to stay? Stay with us for a debate on that.
The United States is bracing for the inauguration of Joe Biden as the country's 46th president on January 20th. Before and after winning the race, Biden repeatedly pledged to unify the country after 4 years of divisive politics of his predecessor, Donald Trump. He will certainly make that call again in his inaugural address just weeks after Trump supporters stormed the Capitol building in an unprecedented bid to overturn the presidential election outcome. The January 6 events are a stark reminder that the transfer of power in the U.S. will be a rough ride. They also indicate that the incoming president will inherit a deeply divided nation and a crisis-laden White House. Biden will be inaugurated despite a large segment of Americans still viewing Trump as a winner of the presidential race. Nearly 75 million Americans who voted for Trump still question the legitimacy of the results despite the Electoral College and the U.S. Congress confirming Biden's victory. These divisions have pushed the U.S. to the verge of becoming a police state, with thousands of National Guard troops and police deployed across Washington, D.C. The state capitals are also on high security alert amid FBI warnings of potential violence during the presidential inauguration. Ironically, a country long known for its voluntary securitization of democratic institutions of other nations is now struggling to protect itself from its very own citizens. However, tensions are not limited to the public alone. It appears that the intensifying partisan antagonism, as has been the case during Trump's 4 years, is going to remain an outstanding characteristic of American politics. From foreign policy to domestic issues, ranging from the economy, the new coronavirus pandemic, to the impeachment of the president himself, Democrat and Republican congressmen are highly at odds along different lines. Will the American society heal anytime soon? The election marked by fraud claims, the recent breach of the Capitol, as well as anger over racial discrimination and police brutality, all reaffirm the U.S. is being torn apart. Biden has vowed to look beyond red and blue to discard harsh rhetoric that characterizes the current state of U.S. politics. Only time will tell if he can really find a solution for such a long-seated division.
Let's get started with the debate show. Joining me will be author and political commentator Ian Williams from New York and writer of Geopolitics and Economist, Economic Alliance, Sir Charles Orter, also joining us from New York. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Ian, the number of National Guard troops in D.C. exceeds the number of U.S. troops deployed to Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan combined. Is such a huge deployment supposed to protect Americans against Americans?
It's to protect the incoming president and the institutions against small bands of marauding Americans. It's not as unprecedented as everybody seems. They've had large crowds like this before. In faced with popular protest about unemployment, Eisenhower pulled in the troops. They broke up the homeless cities in Washington. So a lot of people are raising their eyebrows as though this is completely unprecedented. What happened in the Capitol Hill was shocking, but it almost happened in state houses all over the country recently, and more to the point, historically it happened all the way through Reconstruction. Whenever there was a black majority elected, you found that white mobs disguised as militia turned up there, had a military coup, often linked to people concerned, and were given impunity by the federal law enforcement once the federal troops had been withdrawn after the Civil War. They were given impunity by the police and the FBI and the others, who basically let them get away with mass murder. So you can almost see it, if you saw the interviews with the people who took part in this, there's a serious sense of indignation and entitlement, but they're not supposed to stop us. The police aren't there to stop us. The police are to stop the other guys. The police are to beat up the black people. They're to beat up the leftists, but we're the ones on their side. They're supposed to be with us. And this, I can only call it a brown shirt mentality, because it is how Hitler's brown shirts thrive. Because they had impunity for committing political acts from the police and the state forces in Germany at the time. And that's the way these people behave. They are really shocked. Now, the question is whether you can go through. But, you look, there's an Air Force officer there who had a track record of making threats. He had handcuffs in his hand. He was in uniform, a uniform, protectively in the Capitol, and he was released on bail in the run-up to the inauguration. So you can almost see that even under these changed circumstances, they have a sort of serious expectation of impunity that it won't apply to them. Okay. You know, a lot of them were arrested and released on bail. That did not happen to the Black Lives people. They're arrested on suspicion, and they throw away the key more often than not. Whether they should or shouldn't, you know, you can disapprove of burning places and attacking the police. But if one set of people can do it with impunity and the other can't, then it's a real symbol of what's happened. And this is 4 years after Obama was the president of the United States, and it just shows the measure to which Donald Trump has reversed history, attempted to reverse history, with some degree of success. But it's the poll figures suggest that he's on a loser in the long term. Most Americans polled last week thought that the police did behave far more leniently to the rioters on the Capitol Hill than they would have done to a black crowd doing the same thing. Which, you know, it's a measure of some degree of introspection on the part of the American public and electorate that they noticed it. On the other hand, significant proportion of Republicans denied it, and if anything, said that the police were hard on them and were far too lenient on the black demonstrators. And it's this bipolar detachment from reality which Biden has to deal with. These people aren't going to believe anything.
Okay.
The only thing he doesn't have to deal with is that Trump is not now. He's canceled himself out as the putative leader of the opposition, which he was almost certainly going to be. It was a new post for America, because usually the failing candidate just disappears. He was going to stay there and vociferously guide in the opposition, which, of course, was one of the reasons why the Republican leadership threw him overboard. They didn't want him anymore. They got rid of him. He was no more use to them for winning elections.
Now, Charles, many experts believe that the United States is experiencing a deep-rooted political and social divide. What has led the country to such a polarized state?
Well, I think it's a good question. You've got to go back over a longer period of history. I think the first mistake that your analyst in the package made in assessing the current state of affairs is that it is not simply a Republican versus Democrat debate. There's a feeling in this country, I think justifiable, that both political parties have failed advocates of either conservative ideals or progressive ideals, and a large percentage of the population is anti-both party. So you're talking about independents, you're talking about Republicans, you're talking about Democrats, and most of the polls don't sample properly, but either by underweighting independents or by skewing to Democrats over Republicans, what public opinion may be. The second piece of the equation is, I would argue, that since about 2002, with the advent of broadband, internet, and technological advances, people who work in the private sector have seen their per-hour inflation-adjusted wages plummet. So there's a deep-seated dissatisfaction in this country with how the elites are managing things to the expense of the underclass, which is really 80-85% of all private sector workers. And that's really, I think, the most combustible thing, that if you believe as a passionate youth, age 25 or whatever, that you could never make a go of it in the system, you're drawn to the BLM rallies, the Antifa rallies, let's burn the system down, let's start from scratch. So it's a very vexing set of problems. At present, America remains the largest, most successful economy, the wealthiest collection of people on the planet, but we also have a towering debt and structural government deficits that have not, all the spending has not cured the underlying problems.
Okay. Now, Ian, there are a number of analysts who are concerned that this Trumpism is not going to go away. They argue it's there to stay. Do you share the same view?
Well, I agree with a lot of what Charles just said. The secret of Trump's success was the fact that a lot of people in this country felt totally neglected. The antipathy to Clinton was partly because she's the epitome of the Democrats who abandon all principles. They how should we say, militant middle. They're looking after the comfortably off, and she wouldn't go campaigning in the Rust Belt. It's significant that a lot of Bernie Sanders voters went for Trump because he represented the type of protest we're just talking about. And I'm not sure I've seen real signs yet that Biden has realized the depth of this problem. It's not just since 2002, by the way. It's since 1973. Since the Reagan era, working class wages have declined in real terms at a time of unprecedented productivity, of unprecedented wealth. I always find it difficult to say creation in connection with these billionaires, but wealth appropriation by these people. The country is producing more and more money, and more of it is going into the hands of the few. Both sides see this. And the fact that the Democrats have let the... this is the real irony. It's turkeys clamoring for Thanksgiving, because all of these people demonstrating there about plutocracy were demonstrating objectively in support of plutocracy. Trump did nothing at all to help ordinary people in this country. In fact, most of his measures were designed to thwart their efforts. But he presented himself as it, and this is where the image comes in. The image is very important. So Trumpism will continue. But, to some extent, I think that Trump was a unique character who managed to pull all this together. Whether the Republicans can pull another one, I don't think Mike Pence, and certainly not the Lee Mitch McConnell, have the charismatic populist sort of gung-ho of Trump. Because it's amazing. Trump is a political genius. I mean, there's no end about it. I don't think he sat there and thought his strategy out. He didn't sit in a cell writing Mein Kampf or anything like that. Just every time he opened his mouth, he had a straight into the ears of those disaffected people we're talking about. Mm-hmm. What he said was music to their ears, and it's like the famous journalist H.L. Mencken said that, at some point the great mass of American idiots will discover that they've got their life's wish and they've elected one of them as president. And that's what it was. This man was ignorant, he was uncultured, he was rich, but behaved like a nouveau riche, even though he was old money. It's one of the Republican playbook characteristics now. George W. Bush acted like a corn-pone cowboy when he came from many generations born with silver spoons in their mouth in the Northeast. But he acted like a Texan, chewed tobacco. Even at Harvard, apparently, he chewed tobacco. Mm-hmm. It was a cultivated persona, and Trump didn't have to cultivate it. Trump was genuinely a Philistine. He didn't have to work on it. He's on the genetic Philistine. So he behaved like the people he was appealing to, and they appreciated it. He knew this. Mm-hmm. There was a resonance there, and I just hope it's gone away with what's happened. I hope he's blown it. But, the man has got deep reserves, and it's not with admiration I say that I would not discount him.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, Charles, there are more than 70 million Americans who voted for Donald Trump this time around. So, and that's the second highest total in American history. What's going to happen now? I mean, how would his supporters feel about this? How would they react?
Well, I think that to take issue with just one comment that my distinguished colleague made, I said that starting 2002, the pace at which the plight of the working person's after-tax real incomes declined accelerated rapidly. And that really is, it was a sudden shift downwards, and it's been low ever since. I think that the Trump supporters and Trump himself can point to a lot of accomplishments under the Trump presidency, domestically as concerned unemployment and wage increases and job creation, particularly for undereducated or uneducated people without a high school degree or maybe a few years of college. Across different minority groups among women, there was great strides made in the 4 years of really in the 3 years before the pandemic, and then internationally, if Barack Obama had achieved one of the Abrahamic Accords, just one, he would have gotten another Nobel Peace Prize. Well, we could talk about all of the different international accomplishments. Trump did not start a single war. You can say that maybe by encouraging NBS. He's partially responsible for Yemen, what was happening in Yemen, but the United States did not get engaged in a war under his presidency.
Yeah, but he sold weapons to Saudis.
He strengthened the military, but he didn't instigate the kind of conflicts that Barack Obama did.
Okay. And my question remained unanswered, Charles. Can you answer that? What are those 70 million plus Americans going to do when Trump is no more in office?
Well, they're going to look for a new candidate. I mean, I think the truth is that from 2008 forward, we've had the illusion of prosperity. You can go further back even to 2001 forward, because central banks have suppressed interest rates and pushed up asset values, and the rich are happy in that environment. Now, as we see debt loads surge across the planet, there's going to be a reckoning, a capital markets crisis, a stock markets crisis, and Joe Biden does not have the basic instincts to address that crisis properly, nor does his team. So there are going to be great challenges under this Biden administration.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to be tested around the world, particularly by the Chinese. And there are, as you correctly point out, 74 million people who think that perhaps the election result was stolen from them. So they're not going to unify behind Biden.
Okay, now, Ian, regarding issues...
Only half of them think the election was stolen. About half the people who voted accept half the people who voted Republican seem to accept the results. The other half are still disputing it. It's it's difficult, and we shouldn't merge the figures together. That's one of the problems, as you yourself before pointed out, that everything is lumped in a binary fashion here. You have to be either Democrat or Republican, when an awful lot of people can't tell the difference, especially when it comes down to individual candidates. And you know, the loathing with which the Clintons were sort of treated and thought by many of so-called Democratic voters was considerable. I mean, a lot of those people voted for Trump, not because they liked Trump, but because they disliked Hillary and Bill Clinton so much.
Mm-hmm.
It's these issues which are the type of polling that they do here on binary two-party system doesn't always calculate in the final mix, which is why everybody is chasing for the middle, because they assume if there are two blocks of what's called extremes. I don't think they're extremes. I don't think the extreme Democrats want something of soggy Dutch or soggy Swedes. They're not extremists at all. They don't go around shooting and lynching, and they don't go threatening people. They don't burn down the Capitol. Maybe they would have got further if they had done in the past, but they didn't. And they're extreme moderates, if anything. But it's very difficult to pass these numbers over that. But what we do know is, unless something changes, Biden is the person who, after all, destroyed bankruptcy protection for these people. He was the one who made it so they lost their homes. He framed the legislation as the Senator for Delaware and the insurance companies. So now it's up to him to redeem himself and show that he does have a plan that's going to protect the weaker people in America, the people who have been cheated for the last 20, 30 years or more. And I don't completely see signs. Some of his appointments are reasonable, but he's actually been very careful to cultivate the middle again. And the trouble is, as we all know, the old saying has it, if you stand in the middle of the road, you get hit by the traffic on both directions.
Okay. On that note, we come to the end of this debate. Let me thank our guests. We had author and political commentator Ian Williams and writer and economic analyst Charles Orter, both of them from New York. I'm your host, Behruz Najafi. I'll see you next time.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
first type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. By Hujjatul Islam, Zaid As-Salam.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi at-tahirin. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And welcome to IRIB English Radio and another program for humanity where we are discussing the treatise of rights of Imam Zain al-Abidin alayhi salam. We have reached up to the right number 37, which is the right of the adversary. In the Arabic word, the word khasm has been used. And khasm is someone who has an issue with you or someone who has a claim. And this claim could be a claim that they might have against you, or it could be a claim that you might have against somebody else. And that pretty much means that the word khasm or adversary is going to be taken in two ways. And this is exactly how Imam Zain al-Abidin, peace be upon him, describes it. In the first section, he speaks about the adversary of someone who has a claim against you, and then he goes into speaking about the rights of the adversary against whom you have a claim. And in both cases, we need to initially understand that in the nature of our living as human beings, with interacting with other people, we are going to have times where we will be confrontational, where we will have an issue, we will have a disagreement, a misunderstanding, and unfortunately it could lead to major conflict and problems. The reason being is, as human beings, it's within our nature that we want to seek that which benefits us, and we want to avoid or repel or distance ourselves away from that which is going to be detrimental or damaging to us. And that's going to mean that we will have to kind of stand up for our rights and defend ourselves. And on this basis, we know that when it comes to our religion, Islam, in Islam, it educates us from the outset of how one is able to engage with the rest of people in society. Seeing that it is our nature to want to live with the rest of civilization, we need to have a clear understanding of how we must conduct ourselves should there be a time of conflict. And this is all for the sake of making sure that the human soul does not go beyond what it is that it has as far as its rights and recommendations are concerned. It's on this basis that we see that the educational school of Islam has engaged human in learning and studying and educating themselves. And this is for the purpose of the soul elevating